On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is a rumble going on inside the big tent of American conservatism, and it's only getting louder. After years of marching from victory to victory over the left, the right's neocons, theocons, paleocons, and libertarians are now at each other's throats. Reagan-era conservatives calling George Bush a traitor bent on big spending and big government. Bill Buckley calling the Iraq War a mistake. Competing GOP panels warring bitterly today over immigration. George Will calls it an identity crisis on the right. A new landmark encyclopedia of American conservatism takes us back to first principles in the conservative rumpus. Up next on Point, the roots of the identity crisis in American conservatism and the raging battle lines today. Joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Bruce Fronin. He's professor of law at Ave Maria Law School, a Roman Catholic law school known for its solidly conservative principles. Judge Robert Bork also teaches there. Bruce Fronin is author of Virtue and the Promise of Conservatism, The Legacy of Burke and Tocqueville, and he is co-editor of the remarkable new volume American Conservatism, an encyclopedia. Bill Buckley calls it terrific. The Conservative National Review enthuses with an exclamation point, we now have an encyclopedia. Bruce Fronin, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Fronin.
Hi. Bruce Fronin, 16 years in the making of this encyclopedia. That's a long time and a lot of work. I'm looking here at the entries, and, you know, it's a lot of what you would expect and some of what you wouldn't. But here's, of course, William F. Buckley Jr. himself and Burke, Edmund, and Burkean conservatism, Henry Clay, Grover Cleveland, Culture Wars, Jerry Falwell, Family Research Council. What was the impulse behind the making of this great tome?
Well, the original title was to be an Encyclopedia of the American Right, because there had been put out by a different publisher an Encyclopedia of the American Left. So the idea was simply to give coverage of that side of the political spectrum. When the current publishers, Intercollegiate Studies Institute, took over, we expanded on that idea a bit to attempt to present all of the different figures who went into the making of the post-war conservative movement, and to sort of stress through some of the people who hadn't been heard of, to make people more familiar with some of the debates and some of the strains of thought within conservatism.
It's surprising in some ways, but it tells us about your project. And we want to get to this identity crisis, but about your project, who's in and who's not. No Tom DeLay here, no Grover Norquist, no Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, Karl Rove. What was your criteria for who's in and who's not?
Well, this is a book on the roots, as it were. Mm-hmm. We're trying to give people an idea of where things have come from. So I wouldn't say that you have to be dead to be in here, but it helps.
As in most encyclopedias.
Yeah, sure, and art galleries. Yes. The notion is you have to have had a solid impact, and Tom DeLay certainly had a short-term impact, but we'll see in 10 years. And the same with a large number of the journalists. I mean, Rush Limbaugh did make it in, not necessarily because he's the deepest thinker out there, but because he was part of this great phenomenon of radio journalism and the political talk.
Of course, it does go to the roots here and reminds us of all the people and all the thinking over how many years sort of are buried in this school of political worldview. And then we see, and it's right here in the introduction, the opening page of the encyclopedia, that after all these years of successes, and even during and before them, I suppose, there is a kind of identity crisis that in an odd way, success has made more vivid, hotter than it's been in a long, long time, maybe ever. I'm sure you've watched along with us Bruce Bartlett saying, you know, the right's headed for breakup, for divorce, Bush and the conservatives. Mm-hmm. Peggy Noonan saying, you know, there's a schism between Bush and his base, saying that the Jack Abramoff affair is a symptom of a new Republican culture indifferent to government largesse. I mean, a phrase almost, you know, would seem to be inimical to conservatives. George Wilson, we've got an identity crisis here. We want to spend some time in this hour with you, Bruce, going back to the kind of roots of that identity crisis. How do you see the crisis and begin to take us into these different schools and routes that help explain it.
Well, of course, one of the things you can't ignore is the simple fact that once a group of people get the levers of power, you get an argument over how those levers, how that power ought to be used. Mm. So there's some natural things that come about here. When you add to that the fact that what had formerly joined these disparate groups, which is anti-communism, you know, the feel that there is a threat from the Soviet Union in particular, well, obviously that threat is no longer there.
Once
we won the Cold War, the question became, what next? And this really laid bare the disagreements among the various groups that have gone back from its very beginning, that have always been there.
I want to dive into those. But before we do, Jack Beatty, chime in here with us. I mean, you've been thumbing through this this great compendium. Just your first thoughts on the kind of profile presented by a brand new, the number one Encyclopedia of American Conservatism.
Well, what I'm struck with is how self-critical it is. Again and again, the editors seem to look at what we think of as settled conservative positions and say, well, maybe not. Maybe they're about political expediency, not about principle. Their entry on capitalism is fairly cool to this great disruptive force. So again and again, I think that there's an intellectual honesty in this volume that's very appealing.
Bruce Fronin, I wish you'd take us maybe first to the kind of common bedrock here that most everything grows out of. Then we'll get to where the things branch off and get difficult. But just take us to the fundamental of conservatism in the Encyclopedia of American Conservatism. How do you define it?
Well, at its base, it's really as much a disposition as it is a body of thought. It's this desire to conserve what's been handed on to you. It's a kind of respect for the way your parents did things, the way your grandparents did things, the way that your way of life has grown over time.
Is that an idolatry of the past or something else?
Well, it can become that. I mean, there's a natural danger, as I think with all good things, there's a natural tension in there between attempting to conserve and creating what you've been given and making that into itself a form of religion. Because, of course, what's necessary from a conservative viewpoint is to maintain not society exactly as it is, because life isn't that way. Mm. You're always going to have to face new circumstances. The question is, how do you want to face them? And I think, you know, Michael Oakeshott, a famous British philosopher, mm-hmm. said that the goal of a conservative has to be to try to maintain the coherence of your tradition and of your society. And maintaining that coherence does mean at times you have to change. But that's why we get back to the notion of a disposition. It is that you think that basically things are okay, that you need to value what you've been given in order to improve it.
And value it because it's seen as the kind of, the manifest wisdom of centuries.
Yes, because we shouldn't simply dispense with the wisdom of the ages. The fact that it's lasted is a point in its favor, several points in its favor, actually. But also because it has produced us. Because you value the way of life that you personally have. Now, what that points to, of course, is the possibility that what you have may not be worth saving. For instance, the idea of a conservative in Stalinist Russia would make no sense to a conservative. What you have instead is the growth of people like Solzhenitsyn, who wanted to face the troubles that totalitarianism had brought to his nation. He wanted to get rid of communism. But how did he want to get rid of that? By looking back into his own history, toward the Russian Orthodox Church, toward local democratic communities that he would often talk of. And you see this across the spectrum. Edmund Burke, when he talked about the problems of the French Revolution.
The sort of galvanizing event in the galvanizing of conservative thought.
You bet, because that was all about the victory of an abstract reason over any form of tradition. But what did Burke say? He said that, you know, it's true. There were a lot of bad things going on under the old French monarchy. It was far too dismissive of individual rights. It was far too harsh on poor people. But then he said, but what should you have done in order to reform that? You should not have thrown away everything that you'd been handed down to you. Instead of that, you should have looked back to your own history, the local parliaments that you had already had, the local representative bodies that had grown over time, which had fallen into disuse for, well, about 100 years. You had to reach back and try to reform within the general outlines of the culture that you had.
And now here we are, some 100 years after that revolution, your co-editor on the new encyclopedia, criticizing President Bush and the sort of Bush conservatism for what he calls big education, big spending, big war, big government of Republican leaders. The Donnybrook is on here at the height of conservative American conservative success.
Well, and there's a real question there as to whether this is going to be the height of the success as well. As I think you may have noted yourself, things are looking a little fragile at this stage. What's going to happen with the next elections? We certainly all see the public opinion polls and where the current president stands in those. So that's made it more possible for this simmering resentment among traditional conservatives to surface.
Bruce Fronin, I wish you would sort of paint the battle lines for us, and then we'll follow them back to the to their roots in thinkers and institutions of yore. But how do you see the identity crisis battle lines in the conservative realm today?
Well, I think you can point to a couple of salient issues that are really splitting things. Chief among those, I think, is the war in Iraq. You have two sides of the Republican Party, really. One which is very much in favor of regime change, sticking it out, making over the Middle East in the image of the United States, whereas more traditional conservatives reject the whole notion of regime change. They think cultures are what they are, and it's not really our business to try to change them. So that's one of the large issues.
And this is kind of the neocon-paleocon split, maybe.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Although paleocon tends to be a name that neocons try to tack on to.
Ancient, extinct. Like. So you, what would you say? Traditional conservatives? Or how would
that's,
you?
Yeah, that's the phrase I usually use is traditional conservative. Okay. If you have to be pithy, I'd say trad.
Okay. So war in Iraq, one big dividing point. Interestingly, in the conservative media, that doesn't show up so much. I mean, the big bullhorns on the conservative side are pretty much in solidarity on Stay the Course with President Bush.
It's true, of course. And it's something that I actually get a little personally involved in here because there's such a natural desire to be patriotic among conservatives. You put a flag up, a conservative is probably going to salute it. And that's a good impulse. But unfortunately, I think that impulse is being abused a bit these days, as if to say that not being in favor of this war, and in particular the way it's being run, makes one unpatriotic.
Okay, so this war in Iraq is one big parting of ways. What are the other major ones?
Another major parting of ways has to do with simple centralization of power in Washington, D.C. There is a real long tradition of localism among conservatives, and that seems to be losing steam or certainly representation.
How do traditional conservatives see President Bush's record on that score?
This is one you actually hear a fair amount about, that there's a problem. Again, you mentioned the actual word traitor, but certainly when you...
That was Bruce Bartlett's word, as I recall, Reagan aide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, former Reagan aide, who actually used to work for one of the big establishment conservative think tanks and was asked to leave, which shows how nasty things are getting. But the activists tend to be willing to say, to criticize the administration over these kinds of issues. It's pretty darned unpopular, even though, frankly, I think it's pretty darn necessary if you're going to maintain support for this war. Mm-hmm. So it's all really much of a piece.
So there's centralization, and with that, we hear a lot of outcry, though the GOP has led it, but this deficit spending must be a big divider, too.
Yeah, yeah. Despite the headway that Jack Kemp and the other supply-siders made to the notion that deficits aren't that big a deal, there's still a large part of conservatives, the conservative movement, who simply see deficits as mortgaging our children's future.
So take us back then. If here's the outline, and you say that, it's getting, many people say, it's getting very hot, even to the point where there could be splits. If we see setbacks for the GOP in the midterm elections this fall, you could see more big cracks emerging. But this didn't all just come out of nowhere. Take us back to the kind of roots, the antecedents that you've got in your encyclopedia here, that if we read them all over time, might have left us thinking conservatives might one day split.
Sure, sure. Well, the first thing to keep in mind, of course, is that when post-war conservatism, post-World War II conservatism was born, these folks were actually referred to as the new conservatives, believe it or not. But mm-hmm. when Russell Kirk wrote The Conservative Mind, this was a new thing. Mm-hmm. Because previous to that, you know, Trilling was right. Conservatism was not a terribly intellectual movement. What you tended to have were people who were very opposed to the New Deal mm-hmm. and isolationists. And that kind of combination sort of defined the right in America. Kirk, Buckley, Robert Nisbet, a number of other figures in the early 1950s produced a much more coherent, much more intellectual version of conservatism, which emphasized this opposition to change, this love of our culture, which thickened conservatism. But they weren't alone. Conservatism from the very beginning was a coalition of these more traditional conservatives, which included Southern agrarians, but also included libertarians, who were not at all fond of tradition, who saw the whole goal as being one of getting government out of the way so that individuals could have the maximum amount of individual freedom possible.
So there's a tension from the get-go. How do then neocons and what's being called today theocons fit into that line of descent?
Well, the neocons didn't really come along until the late 60s, early 70s. These were people who had been Trotskyites, various forms of Marxists back in the 30s. And over the course of the 50s and 60s, because of their anti-communism, most of them had become anti-communists, they'd lost their Marxist roots, had made kind of coalitions with other conservative figures. And when the 60s came along and the blow-ups on campus and the radical social policies that came out of that, well, they rejected this to court. And they ended up joining, frankly, the Nixon administration. Daniel Patrick Moynihan mm-hmm. was a major figure there. So they entered into a much broader coalition, which was held together by a kind of opposition to communism and an opposition to what was seen as the radicalism of the 60s.
And what about the so-called theocons, the religious right? I mean, you've got it right here in your entry on conservatism in the midst of these 900 and some pages that, you know, wanting to further the common good in a manner pleasing to God is at the heart of conservatism. But then the theocon movement takes that to a kind of new plane.
Well, they take it to a new plane, but they're also sort of looking backward toward what was a much more mainstream view of conservatism back in the 50s and the 60s. It's hard to imagine, you know, but as we get older, when you remember your childhood, I mean, people spoke much more openly about religious issues 20, 30, 40 years ago than they do today. These people are still speaking in that same voice with a renewed kind of vigor. And bringing it explicitly to the fore, especially over issues like abortion.
So God is front and center in this conservative vein, but do you see it overall as leaning toward the neocon impulse, which is not so unfriendly to government, not so unfriendly to foreign engagement, or to the traditional conservative view?
Well, that's sort of the ironic part of it all, because in terms of foreign policy issues, in terms of the size of government, the theocons tend to be neocons. People like Michael Novak, Richard John Neuhaus, these are people who are completely on board in terms of Iraq war, in terms of this defense of capitalism, in terms of defense of a certain kind of view toward welfare policy, and much less leery of centralization in Washington, D.C.
And if push comes to shove here, if conservatives go to the mat, I mean, they've won the White House and both houses of Congress, big influence on the Supreme Court now, war in Iraq, but if they go to the mat, who wins? Traditional conservatives or neocons, or who's got the steering wheel here, Bruce Ronan?
Well, that's again, you're talking about a very ironic situation because I think it's clear that in terms of gaining control over the various apparatuses and institutions of power, the neocons have already won. There are very few traditional conservatives who are in the big institutions, the Heritage Foundation, places like that, and in the party. The question is whether their troops are going to disappear. And what good is an apparatus if there's no one that you're actually working with?
That is, will the neocons' troops desert the field?
Yeah.
The voters, conservative voters in particular.
Right, right. Because, of course, most voters are neither one. They're trying to pick between these policies.
Jack Beattie, what do you make of this, the lay of the identity crisis battlefield in the conservative arena here?
Well, I think Bruce puts it in terms of these current issues very well, but I think it also has a deeper root, and that is this basic conservative idea of tradition. Tradition as a moral compass. Well, of course, liberals object to that because lots of things that are traditional, Jim Crow, racism, male supremacy, are not desirable. They're not good. The idea that what Burke called prejudice, the accretion of wisdom of the past, that instinctive assent we give to things, the idea that that's an adequate moral compass, liberals strongly criticize. But I think also that the libertarians have a big problem with that as well, and that's another split in conservatism. The people who think, I mean, conservatism for many people is an apology for big business. For capitalism. And nothing in history is more revolutionary than capitalism. Marx said, everything that's solid melts into air. That's what capitalism does. It dissolves traditions. And I think that split between people who basically get up every morning and think, let the market rip and let's have no restraint on the market, and you liberals who want to interfere with this, by gosh, you're getting in the way of the machine. Mm. We don't need that stability. I'm wondering if those liberals aren't in certain ways closer to traditional conservatives than the libertarian conservatives.
You know, Jack, Bruce Fronin, we've got callers who want to speak to exactly that. I want to turn to them. We're at 800-423-TALK. That's 800-423-8255. And Karen is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Very well. What do you think, Karen?
I think Jack Beatty just beat me to the punch.
give us your uppercut.
We must be channeling. No, he hit it right on. As soon as I heard this conversation, I remembered a passage in a book by Gary Wills, the wonderful historian and writer.
And no mean conservative himself.
Well, he's kind of an interesting guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's made some changes in his thinking. Mm-hmm. But he wrote a chapter that had precisely to do with Jack's point, that conservatives are sort of stuck in a real conundrum, particularly when it comes to, as Jack said, there's nothing more revolutionary than capitalism. Capitalism wipes out the old, absolutely destroys it. That's what it's supposed to do.
Creative destruction. It's right there.
And then, of course, people who value tradition in the social and cultural arena, you know, they can't exactly blame the market for example, inventing contraceptives.
Mm-hmm.
They got to blame somebody.
But here they are, right.
Let's blame the liberals. There's nothing has destroyed the values and the structures that conservatives and many people who wouldn't call themselves conservatives but share a respect for tradition in the past, nothing has done more to destroy those structures than the tangible material inventions of the 20th century.
And yet we associate the market and capitalism almost fundamentally with conservatism. Karen, it's a great point, well elaborated on there for Jack. Bruce Fronin, take us up to your mountain range of conservative thinkers here. How do they wrestle with this tension here between conservatism and capitalism?
This is such a great point and so important. I think what I'd like to go back to is the exact phrase that you use, creative destruction. Mm. I think it's important to remember that phrase, which is used today as a great clarion call, was originally coined by Joseph Schumpeter in describing how capitalism would end up undermining itself and destroying itself, because creative destruction is a bad thing.
Of course, in the 90s, that's the banner everybody raised, and, you know, right. What could be better?
Exactly right. But I think what you need to look at, and this is reflected in a number of the entries in the encyclopedia, including G.K. Chesterton, Russell Kirk, for example, referred to capitalism as a destructive ideology.
Now, Russell Kirk is sort of your great hero, so where do you come down here?
To the extent that what we're talking about is economic liberties, freedom from federal regulation, I think you'll find most conservatives agreeing that that is a good thing. But that's very different from the notion of this great capitalist national market. Right from the beginning in America, you had a lot of conservatives who were worried about the ways in which big business was being formed and helped by the government. Right from the early Marshall Supreme Court back in the early 19th century, when they would do away with local regulations in the name of national markets, to the laissez-faire court in the 19th century, to all of these Bush decisions protecting large businesses, including making sure they have a large supply of illegal aliens to work for and to pay almost nothing for, you have had a government which seeks to help those who are rich gain power in the name of efficiency.
But talk about attention and one that that traditional view seems to be on the losing side of. I want to look more at that, but we've got callers as well. Bruce, Jay is calling from Nashville. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good morning. Love your show. Even when I listen to it, it makes me angry. I love the show.
Love you right back. What's on your mind, Jay?
Well, I'm angry today because I'm a Southern male. Mm-hmm. I'm 63 years old. I voted for a Republican on a federal office level every year since 1964.
That's a long time.
And the Bush administration and the current GOP leadership, they think people like me who have voted for them repeatedly that I have no choice, that I have to vote for them because I'll never vote for a Democrat or any other candidate like that. Well, I've made up my mind after, 42 years.
Yep.
I am so angry with the way they have betrayed us. I'm a traditionalist. I'm a constitutionalist. They're taking me for granted, my vote, every election. This year we have an open election seat in Tennessee with Senator Frisch retiring. I'm going to vote for Harold Ford, Jr.
Democrat.
I've never voted for a Democrat on a federal election level in my entire life.
That's amazing. Jay, what has most got your goat as a long-standing conservative?
Well, the consolidation of government on the federal level, the national debt and the annual deficits, and just the absolute unjustified war in Iraq. It betrays Western civilization to have gone to war in Iraq. No congressional mandate for that war. Congress did not declare war. And across the level, I've got a list about 12 points long. I won't go into them. but I have got to convince the GOP somehow that they've got to get back on the track, something like the 94 campaign. That wasn't perfect, but something like that.
But to remake itself, to retool itself.
Exactly. I think they have to lose an election cycle to come back to grasp with where they ought to be.
Bruce, what do you make of that? Is that a widespread conservative view? Is Jay in a minority? How do you size up the size of the armies here?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that the Republican Party gained the ascendancy largely because evangelicals came out and started voting. They hadn't, historically, up through the 1950s. And I think what may happen is you'll have some people following Jay and casting protest votes, but I think it's far more likely that more people, especially in the South, especially those who are very religious, will start staying home again.
But George Bush, as you said, the so-called theocons have been pretty strong on the war in Iraq. The GOP has waved the gay rights, gay marriage flag. I mean, they're still working the levers to try and keep the evangelicals on board here.
Yep, they're trying to, and they've got the evangelical elites still on board. But I think it's a very shallow support that they've got, and really only among a very few people who are active in the public square.
But
I think you're going to get a lot of malaise out there.
Jack, this is such an interesting picture where the Democrats in recent years have often been described as kind of in disarray and, you know, not rallied around a central theme and so on. Now, Bruce Fronin paints a picture of conservatives with their own, behind the facade of power, which is a very big one right now, with their own kind of meltdown going on.
Meltdown, one way. Another way to put it is life, liveliness, contention.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, conservatives are a governing majority now, and governing majorities contain multitudes. That's how they get to be governing majorities. They have big tents. And, boy, look at the Democrats in their heyday. They had Southern racists and Northern liberals. I mean, then huge difference. And yet they all stayed under the big New Deal tent because they had a common goal. And I think what the conservatives have a similar problem, that in some ways the contentions are a sign of the liveliness in the movement and the fact that it is a governing majority and that you've got to make accommodations for people who don't really agree with you about many things because you agree about some things.
Bruce Fronin, what about it? Is this big tent boisterousness? Is that all we've got going on here, or something more, something fundamental?
Well, I take your point. But I think the one thing that I'd add to it is that, you know, Democrats had a goal to keep in common, you know, fighting the Depression, fighting World War II. Mm. Things started falling apart soon after that. And the question really is there something to keep all these groups together? That used to be anti-communism. Meanwhile, I think what you've got now is something that's tearing them apart, the war in Iraq. The question is, will some big issue come out there that will continue to unite them?
And, of course, today we've got these two big kind of competing hearings on immigration on the two coasts. Very different views there as well. Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, what has brought this present crisis on to the conservatives, I'm not going to use that word because that's a euphemism for Republicans, is immigration. Because we think of the Republican Party as a monolith when it's not. It's composed of neoconservative, which is the intellectual branch. And they need these immigrants to fill the boots on the ground because Americans aren't going and they cannot afford to have a draft. The conservatives don't want these immigrants because these immigrants are different from the other immigrants. These aren't hamburger flippers. These are journeymen who are carpenters, bricklayers, and do everything in construction and will work for half the price and no benefits. And they can plead for workman's compensation. Sometimes they can get it, and sometimes they can't. And the constituency for these conservatives, these jobs pay well. And these jobs once belonged to white men, high-paying union jobs. And Bush was put into busted unions, and he has busted unions. And you had an interesting guest on your show one time, Chris Patton, and he explained the difference between neocon and conservative. Neocon in this case does not mean new. So we've come to a point where we're having a clash of American political situations. And how I see it, the Republicans now are reverting back to Americans. They are no longer these ideologues.
You mean Americans as in nativists?
No, Americans as we are Americans. That's our personality. That's what makes us different from the rest of the people in the world, not religion and God and this and the whatever.
Mary, let us pick it up. You're right on the news today with this immigration theme. I don't know if Bruce Fronin will agree with you that neocons have a monopoly on intellectualism. He's not in that camp, and clearly he's got a little intellectual energy running here. But, Bruce, what about the immigration issue and that as a lens on the strains in the conservative camp, Republican camp, as Mary says? How do you see it?
Well, it's obviously a big issue, and it's a very divisive issue. When Pat Buchanan left the Republican Party, it was largely over immigration, and he still does have quite a following. And you've got a lot of opposition to immigration. Some of it is, frankly, racist. A lot of it is rooted in cultural and economic worries, and frankly, I have a certain sympathy for an opposition to the use and abuse, really, of people from other countries to take crummy jobs from us when we happen to need them. Well, what do you do with these people when those jobs are no longer there? You get into all kinds of problems as they've gotten into in Europe. And I think it's frankly deplorable the way that we sought to steal the middle class out of India, for example, using these specialized visas to bring them over, all of their engineers. And so you have a big debate largely over economics. How can we use immigrants for our own purpose, as well as over racial and cultural issues?
Now, is that a principled concern for the immigrant, or is that a conservative concern for what Mary called Americanism, or the American culture as kind of the fundamental thing that conservatives of a certain stripe want to protect?
Yeah, that's an important point, because I think the two issues are really intertwined. Somebody who tries to pretend that it's only one is probably not telling you the truth. But, for instance, I know when my wife's family came from Mexico, the notion was that one should assimilate, but at the same time, her family did not feel the need to shuck off their culture as if it was something just disposable. And I think too often you find this idea that immigrants should come here and become just exactly like us.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that the whole cultural issue is itself all that clean.
But conservatism has embraced the culture itself, and not just American, but sort of Western civilization as a proud guiding light. Is not the multicultural impulse essentially going on here, is it?
Well, but the Western tradition, the Western civilization, is a pretty broad thing. It leaves lots of room for folkways. It leaves lots of room for maintaining customs. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for creative destruction.
Let's turn to Guy in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Guy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really enjoy your show. It's like a classroom every day.
Well, I hope it's a fun one. Thanks,
Guy. Yeah, thank you. Whenever I listen to conservatives, I'm always taken aback how hostile they are to the civil rights movement. What I want to ask the gentleman is, what do conservatives think of the civil rights movement, especially the social movement of the 60s? Because without the social movement of the 60s, blacks, women, and other minorities would not have the rights that they enjoy today. Because at least to me, it seems at times that I would say most conservatives, I don't want to say all of them, most of them are very hostile to the civil rights movement whenever it comes up.
Yeah, Guy, that's a terrific. Let us pick it up. Bruce Fronin, I'm looking here at Jason DePaul's write-up of the encyclopedia for the Times, and he points out about George Wallace, who became governor of Alabama, pledging segregation forever, described mm-hmm. in your encyclopedia as always more complicated than his critics allowed. Talking about your entry on Southern conservatism, paying tribute to the region's, quote, precious Anglo-American continuity, but saying nothing about Jim Crow. So what about American conservatism, the race issue, the civil rights issue, and how you've treated it in the encyclopedia?
Well, the civil rights issue is actually treated in greater depth than that. What you'll find is all of the entries on particular people and movements do tend to try to present a good side, not an uncritical side. George Wallace was certainly far from a scion of all virtues. But once again, you're dealing with a complex set of issues. I mean, let's start from first principles. Jim Crow was a violation of basic human dignity in the same sense that slavery was. So it was undoubtedly a bad thing. You then get into a large number of arguments among conservatives concerning judicial activism, affirmative action, a number of issues there. Now, do you find people, especially Southern agrarians, the so-called New Confederates, who will still defend the notion that there should not have been a 1964 Civil Rights Bill? You're not going to find a lot of them, and certainly no one I would want to associate myself with. But there are other issues along with that which can look like there's a lack of care, a lack of wanting to do the right thing, and a concern with structural issues rather than the real human suffering out there.
You say that it can look that way, but of course, in fact, in political history, conservatives have been real opponents of the civil rights movement on many fronts. You're critical of the Iraq War, but yet the war's going on. I mean, you're a conservative. How do you feel about, you know, what a lot of these things have been wrapped in? The conservative flag.
You mean the war in Iraq?
Well, I mean, you know, whether it's the cultural issues that Mary raised and you described, you responded to, or the Jim Crow issue that Guy raises here, or the Iraq War, you know, we see kind of, again and again, you can point to good things that conservatives have sponsored, but here's any number of things that you yourself are pointing to as negative, and yet they've had the conservative political flag wrapped around that. Why?
Well, in part, it's been politically useful. I mean, if you look at issues of racism, those are American problems. They are Western problems. They're not particularly conservative problems. Woodrow Wilson, as a president, banned blacks from the White House. You had Franklin Roosevelt, who refused to sign on to anti-lynching legislation because it would get in the way of his political coalition. Now, all I'm saying on that is that this is a problem that we all share. Conservatives in particular are painted by this because of the position that they had in the South at this time. Were there too many conservatives on that side out of fear of change? Yes. On the other hand, what happened when policies came in to deal with that? You had an awful lot of powers, elites, using that as an excuse to get rid of people they didn't like. And urban renewal, which, of course, was used to ship the blacks out of town in an awful lot of cities, and not necessarily ones that were controlled by Republicans or conservatives of any stripes. So I think it's somewhat unfair to say that racism is a conservative issue. I think we can all share in some of the troubles in dealing with that.
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, but you know what brought it down? What brought down de jure segregation was active government. I mean, a movement of conscience that finally enlisted, a president from Texas who said, "We shall overcome," and made a revolution in American morals and politics. And that took active government, took an active judiciary striking down Brown v. Board and other decisions, striking down these traditions. It took federal power, sending marshals into the South to look over voting and so on. It took national legislation. All the things that conservatives say are just anathema to them helped deliver America from really this long overlife or half-life of slavery that lasted right up into our own time. It wouldn't have happened without liberalism. Let's put it that way.
Bruce Fernand, do you agree?
Well, it's a powerful point. But I'd like to add to it that Jim Crow would not have been possible without Plessy against Ferguson, which was itself said that separate but equal was okay, a Supreme Court decision imposed by an activist court. And I'm not sure, frankly, that Brown v. Board helped as much as we might like to think that it did. What really mattered, and I agree with you completely on this, was the Civil Rights Act. And unfortunately, because things had been bottled up for so long, I think that issues have become too tendentious. There has been a splintering of our common values as a result of that, which has caused us to go overboard in some ways that are damaging to everyone, frankly. And I think we need to keep in mind that what was undone was itself a kind of government activism.
So here, conservatives, through one lever and another, have come into a lot of power, and now this identity crisis. You describe a lot of intellectual history here. If conservatives are going to work their way back out of this twist that they've got themselves in, drawing on this history, Bruce, how do you think they'd do it?
Localism, return to basic principles, return to a concern that government is, in its very nature, intended to help us live together in decency. That means virtue at the local level. It means minding our own business in the world and trying to treat each other a little bit better than we do right now.
And if your view doesn't out here, doesn't win here, might we end up with sort of staying on this beam with a very different conservatism that we might be looking at in 10 or 20 years that is then considered conservatism, and what you're talking about as indeed paleo?
Yeah, there's a lot of anger out there among some people. And, you know, I have some friends and some former friends who've, frankly, in my view, sort of gone off the deep end in the paleo direction because they feel very hurt. And I'm sorry about that. I think what you're more likely to end up with is a retreat from the polls, a retreat into private life. There'll still be these kind of values, but my own view is that they'll probably show up in a non-political way. Movements like the new urbanism, movements like homeschooling, all kinds of different counter-movements where people will attempt to form their own small communities and survive what they see as a pretty hostile political environment.
And the GOP, in brief, still the conservative party if those conservatives retreat?
No. An establishment party in deep trouble.
Wow. Wow. Bruce Fronin, co-editor of American Conservatism and Encyclopedia. It's a big work and an illuminating one. Professor Fronin, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you for your time and all your labor here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jack Beatty, there's a conversation for you. Wow, we're headed into some strange times.
Yes, intellectually honest, candid, and probably true. Conservatism is having problems.
Well, off we go. Jack, great to have you with us. Thanks very much for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.